Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. So what is that everything? Climate, the environment, touches every aspect of our lives. Financial, the joy of living, politics, even our own mental health. Lots of folks that take a close look at what's going on with the environment, with the climate, struggle with what they find. It's easy to fall into gloom or despair or to give up. That's the part we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking to Dr. Chris Kevorkian. Dr. Kevorkian is a grief counselor, and she specializes in part on counseling those who are suffering from environmental grief, a term that she created herself actually a number of years ago while doing research and realizing at that time at least that this was not a subject that was well understood within the mental health community. So we're going to be talking to her today about how we deal with our own feelings about the climate and the environment and how to keep on going when the going gets tough. Chris does live locally. She lives in Gig Harbor, and it's always especially good, I think, to listen to what folks who are from our community have to say. So here we go. Very happy to have Chris Kevorkian with us today. Greetings, Chris, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking me, John. I really appreciate it.
You bet. So Chris, we're going to learn a bit about Chris right off the bat here. Chris lives in Gig Harbor, Washington, so she's a homie, and that's particularly valuable to us as we focus on climate change and related stuff as it affects us right here in Pierce County, the Salish Sea. Chris is the CEO of an organization called A Grieving World. Chris, could you just start us off and tell us a bit of what A Grieving World is and how it came to be?
Yeah, I started A Grieving World a while ago, actually, just under different names, offering emotional support and counseling, coaching, consultation for people who are dealing with issues of grief and people at the end of life. I call myself a climate thanatologist. I have a background in end-of-life care and grief and loss work through hospice as a hospice medical social worker for many years. And then I pursued a doctoral degree in thanatology, which is a study or science, of death, dying, and grief. And I'm one of a few people in the U.S. with such a degree. But I like to help support people who are trying to find their way through the grieving process and offer education, the emotional support, and guidance, particularly to those also who are affected by the end of life, who need help with the dying process and support through that, as well as paperwork at the end of life, advanced healthcare directives, and so forth.
Yeah, so interesting. So Your interest, your expertise in environmental grief, eco-anxiety, the origins of that are actually in helping people at the end of life. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, actually, I was focusing when I started my doctoral degree, I was asked to contribute something new to the field of thanatology. And I had originally thought of studying after-death communication, because I had seen and I had witnessed that when I was a hospice social worker and was fascinated by it. And my professor said, nope, it's been done. Come up with something new. And I had studied whales most of my life before I got into death and dying and focused on them a little bit more and realized that most of the organizations I had belonged to previously were kind of, the information was still bad. It was getting worse. Environmental issues were getting worse. Whales that I had studied were declining. And so that's kind of how environmental grief came to be. I started thinking about that. And as I was reading about all the organizations I had belonged to before getting into death and dying, things were bleak. And I thought, geez, I was reacting with grief. And I said, I've got environmental grief. And I mentioned this to my doctoral committee, and they said, yeah, that's a great topic. And I kept thinking, great, I wonder who came up with it. They said, it sounds like you did. And I thought, no, I'm not that person. And I was living in Los Angeles at the time, and actually I was in Humboldt County at the time. And then I moved back to Los Angeles to work on my doctoral degree full time, and was spending quite a bit of time at libraries at UCLA asking. And sadly, I was interrogating a lot of the librarians, just begging for help, because I couldn't believe that I would come up with such a term. But I guess I did. It looks like I did. So I focused my research on asking scientists working with orcas, here, the southern residents, asking how they were dealing with the decline of the southern residents. And so that's kind of how environmental grief came to be. And ecological grief is a little bit different. And I haven't focused a lot of research on that, because it just seems to be falling into place where actually a lot of people are mashing ecological grief and environmental grief together, but there is a distinction.
So there's another term. I'm not sure if you've used it so far, but the term is eco-anxiety. So how does environmental grief differ from eco-anxiety?
So good question. So both terms are typically seen in, you know, words have power. I believe words have power and energy behind them. And both words are typically negative. They're quite low frequencies. But I see anxiety as having a bit to do with fear. And in grief, I try and stay away from that. I think there's a lot of worry and fear involved in anxiety, and not to discount it at all, because people certainly have a reason for eco-anxiety these days. But that's a little bit different from ecological grief and environmental grief. Grief I see as an incredible teacher. There's opportunities to learn in grief. And while there's despair, there's pain, there's sadness in grief, there's also beautiful lessons. Because years ago, I was playing with this term griefitude, kind of combining grief, attitude, and gratitude. Because what I find so fascinating about grief is that we wouldn't have the pain and the despair that we have in grief if we didn't have the opportunity to love something so much. And I realize that there's, you know, almost 8 billion people on the planet, and you're bound to reach somebody you might love. But if you don't, you know, you might be falling in love with nature and one of her inhabitants. And I just think it's such a blessing to have that relationship. And so that's why I think grief is such a great teacher, because I'm grateful to have had the relationships I've had, even with the fact that they've left, but I still have those memories. And so I know it sounds hokey, but I just think grief is an amazing teacher, because without grief, I think personally, I wouldn't choose to live my life as fully as I do. I wouldn't choose to spend time the way that I do.
Yeah, does that make sense? Oh, absolutely it does. In fact, I feel like as a layperson, I have experienced what you're talking about to an extent. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I lost a lot of friends in Vietnam. I mean, just dead, gone, 22, 23-year-old young men. And I still carry a lot of grief about that. But, you know, I value that grief. For me, it's the way I honor and remember those men that I loved and served with. And so I value that very clearly. And just a little self-disclosure here, I was doing a counseling session with a counselor once and started weeping about my grief about Vietnam. And she pipes up and says, "Oh, well, I can fix that for you." I says, no, this is not anything I want to fix. This is something that's precious to me. So I definitely get the value of grief. And I think our society tends to think of it in negative terms. So I'm pretty sure I'm understanding what, at least a part of what you're saying about the value of grief.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that story. And I gasped when you said the counselor could fix that. Ooh, that's not something you want to fix.
I swear to God, that's exactly what you said. Well, I can fix that for you.
Yeah, I don't so. Feel that person anymore, because our job is never to fix.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly. I honestly, every loss I've had, and boy, there's been a lot, you know, just in the past couple of years. I think, as we've spoken on the phone before, just, you know, for some people, you hit a certain age and then it's like, boom, all these people start dying.
Yeah.
And for others, they've been experiencing it their entire lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just, to me, again, it's just something that is such a value to people. I think that it's sad when I hear people just want to, the three words I hate the most are get over it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's like, no, let's embrace our grief and learn from it and move forward so that we can establish even stronger connections with those we love.
Yep, for sure. So just looking at myself, difference between environmental grief and eco-anxiety, I got to say that probably I'm more on the eco-anxiety side. Although it's good for me to realize that both of those things are things, because, you know, I've done the deep dive into the climate, and as I look ahead, there's bountiful reasons to be anxious about the future. And it was as those things snuck up on me. I didn't realize that they were there. They were slowly becoming more and more a part of how I experienced life. And it was really a relief to me to find out, oh no, wait a minute. This is the thing. Other people experience this too as they take a look. So I am appreciative of you in particular for naming these things and putting them out there so that we can recognize them and talk about them.
Well, I didn't come up with eco anxiety. Somebody else did that. And I don't know who it is, but whomever it is came up with something good. Because I think, as you're saying, I mean, a lot of us are really feeling this. But for me, again, it goes back to just the energy of the wording and the power behind it. Because, as I mentioned, anxiety comes with a lot of fear. And I think in reality, there could be a lot of fear. But I also think that Mother Nature just has tremendous power. And I think we're doing a disservice to her when we think, you know, things are just going to be much, much worse, because I think she showed us clearly when we were on lockdown, when COVID struck last year and people actually did lock down, just the fact that air quality improved within days.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were dolphins swimming in the Venice canals. And I think that if we're able to give her and all her inhabitants a break, she's able to come back quite a bit. We just need to give her that space and time to do it. But yeah, I think people certainly do have a lot of reason to be anxious, though, about what's happening.
So I'm just thinking about a layperson who is, they're informed and they're watching the world. How would environmental grief affect them in their day-to-day life, or how would they recognize that this is going on? My experience has been that sometimes if something's bothering me and I really can't get my arms wrapped around it, then that affects how I behave in other ways. It might affect my relationships or my job performance or something like that. And I don't have a clear idea of why that is. How would a layperson know that this is what's going on for them?
Well, let's back up a bit, if you don't mind, and let me just define those terms so that could help your listeners understand a little bit more.
Sure.
So environmental grief, I defined it as the grief reaction stemming from the environmental loss of ecosystems caused by natural or man-made events or human events. I see that more as like the loss of a species, like the fact that the southern residents could be going extinct in our lifetimes, perhaps. Or deforestation, clear cutting, all of that I see as environmental grief issues. Ecological grief is a little bit different, because that is the grief reaction stemming from the disconnection and relational loss from our natural world. And I see that sort of in two different ways, because I could see, I was just talking to a climate leader about this yesterday, about the fact that here in Pierce County or in Washington, I think the whole state, we've been warned to bring in our bird feeders because there is a salmonella poisoning or something that's happening with our birds. And they've asked that we bring in bird feeders because we don't want the birds to congregate and then spread this disease. So I have 3 bird feeders, and I was going to get another one because I absolutely love the birds. When I first moved to this area of Gig Harbor, I would hear the birds start chirping around 4:30 in the morning, and it just absolutely made my day. I just so thoroughly enjoyed being woken up by birds instead of traffic or helicopters that I experienced in Los Angeles. So here I was living in this beautiful place with trees surrounding me and listening to the birds. And then there were times when I wouldn't hear the birds, and it wouldn't really depend on a season in particular. It would just be that there were times when I wouldn't hear the birds for months on end. And I would be concerned about, you know, where's the pesticides? Are they not coming back? Are there cats in the area? Anything that's keeping them from coming back? So when I got these bird feeders, I got some really good bird seed, apparently, because I had a few birds coming. And then I think they told their friends that Chris had some really good food, so come swing by her place. And I'd be surrounded by birds, and I loved it. And I had squirrels around too, and just thoroughly enjoyed that. But the fact that I've had to pull these bird feeders back, I'm not seeing the birds as much. I'm not hearing them as much. And to me, that's like an ecological grief experience. But on the flip side, you could also see ecological grief from the perspective of being around people who just don't understand nature or care for her. I know someone was telling me recently about a person, a close friend, who just loved seeing the deer in the area, and unfortunately ended up witnessing a neighbor shoot a deer right in front of her.
And, how horrible.
Yeah. And if I had seen that, I don't know how I would react. I was talking to somebody on the phone today, and as we were talking, 2 deer came by and said hello in my neighborhood, just right in front of the house. And so I can't even imagine how I would feel. But to me, that would also be a huge ecological grief issue, just because of the fact that how could somebody just do that? But I think the same way when we're chopping down, you know, the forests here to build residential and commercial housing and structures. So sorry, I get flustered with this because it's frustrating to me to deal with people who just really don't understand how fortunate we are to have incredible amounts of beauty around us, and we just take them so much for granted.
Yeah, there's an old song line about we don't know what we got till it's gone. You take paradise and put up a parking lot. So that's that so much of our culture seems to be oriented towards man-made stuff. And we do suffer by not being connected with our environment. In fact, I'm sure you're aware of this. There's a whole school of thought, an area of study about the benefits of being exposed directly to nature. You know, a walk in the woods, a walk along the beach, a swim in a river, those kind of things. And our world is so much, seems to be so insulated from those things anymore. So if a person is feeling the kinds of emotional distress you're talking about, what does that person do?
So there's a lot of things that a person can do who's feeling, reacting to these forms of grief. And the best thing that I've heard from a lot of people is connecting with others. When I came up with these terms, nobody really understood what I was feeling. And as I said, pretty much everyone thought I was alone in this. And it was a lonely road. It was tough. But talking with other people now who react to this as I do, there's comfort in it. It feels like, okay, I'm not the only one. And that's nice to know. I encourage people to speak with friends who may feel the same way, get involved in community, speak to people like me. I could certainly help you, support you through this. And then also journaling really helps. And there's a climate journal project that has journals, digital as well as physical journals, where they have some prompts to help kind of guide you along. And I think journaling is so helpful in just about any mental health condition situation you're dealing with, whether it's anger, frustration with family or loved ones, you know, journaling helps. But certainly in this realm, it does as well. Great.
Yeah, so I love to journal myself, although my journal's a little bit oddball, excuse me, but I'll explain that to somebody else someday, but well, okay, I brought it up. I call it a digital journal. I tend to track stuff like how I feel on a scale of 1 to 10 about this thing or that thing, or how connected I'm staying with my community and so on. So anyway, as they say, enough about me. So I love this climate journal notion. We are going to have show notes that will be accessible on the internet afterwards, and I'll find a link to that.
I'll send you their link.
Okay, awesome. And other folks that want to look for that as a resource, and community certainly is probably my saving grace in my own work at dealing with what I see going on in the climate. So one of the things I wonder is it possible to be aware of what's going on with our environment? And of course, I'm particularly interested in climate, which basically covers just about everything in our environment that I can imagine, the changes that are taking place. Is it your view, can we be aware, fully, honestly aware of what's going on with our environment and also enjoy life, be happy, be optimistic, however you want to put it?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that, because I think the one thing that I didn't mention about dealing with these issues is when you're dealing with grief, there are a couple paths that you could take. And one could be not dealing with it, you know, just suppressing it. The other, allowing it to take over your life, which would throw you into a pit of despair. And the other is using your grief to take action. So I encourage people to feel and react to the grief. Take the time to honor yourself for having that, for actually experiencing the grief. And then use that energy to harness the grief towards taking action. So, you know, it might be Citizens Climate Lobby. It might be Climate Reality Project. You might want to get involved in other organizations. Like for me, it's the Rights of Nature, and doing all I can to help the Southern Resident Orcas. But there's, in action, there's healing. So I encourage people to take action, whatever form they can find, that actually is beneficial for them and the planet.
Makes total sense to me. And I think that that's kind of what gets me out of bed every morning and looking forward to my day and thinking, well, maybe I can make some tiny bit of contribution here on my own. So one of the things, Chris, that you've made reference to the Southern Orcas a few times, and I know you're involved with, and you've referred to this also, with Rights of Nature. So could you say a bit about what are we talking about when we talk about Rights of Nature?
So Rights of Nature is a movement that's been going around for quite some time. It's somewhat semi-new to the U.S., but it's building. It's basically giving rights of personhood to nature. So, for instance, in our country, the U.S., we give rights to corporations to have standing in courts. They can file as people, as individuals, if they want to defend themselves in court or fight for anything in court. But nature doesn't have these same rights. And it seems a little crazy to even think about that, because I'm sure nature doesn't think of rights, quote unquote, in any way, shape, or form. So the language is a little particular to us. But I think because we work within this legal structure where rights are a thing, we want to get rights to nature, just as you would a child. Unfortunately, we see children as property, so to speak. And so a child will have someone speak for him or her or they. And I think that we're hoping to get that same sort of system in place for nature, because when you think about it, especially after COVID, I would hope that people would become more and more aware of the fact that, you know, nature could certainly live without us, but we can't live without her. And it seems a little bit odd that in everything we do, we rely on nature to keep us alive, yet she doesn't have a seat at any of the tables in making policy or legislation. And she should be at the head of the table. It's a hard concept for some people to grasp because it's interesting to see how defensive people get. They're like, well, what about my rights? And I just think, you know, you have a lot of rights. We have quite a bit here in the U.S., although not everybody has the same level of rights, that's for sure. But we can, most of us can speak up for our rights. I know that there are a lot of people out there who don't have the rights that they think they deserve, and they should get them before nature, perhaps. But I think we all really need to step back, and it would be wonderful to live in a utopian world where we're not having to deal with this, where we're not living in a world of capitalism and greed, and where everybody wants to get theirs and to heck with the other guy. Ideally, it would be lovely to live so that we can all live, you know, authentically with one another and respectfully. And if we would take the time to respect nature, I think our lives would be way more valuable than they are today.
As a child, I grew up in, let's call it a conservative Christian environment. And I was taught that the world is here for us, that God created the world for us. And all those things, the trees, the animals, the rivers, everything is for us. And so I'm just wondering how a person, and I think there are a lot of people that still hold that kind of perspective. I wonder how rights of nature sounds to somebody with that kind of perspective.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And it's one, I don't know if you ever got to hear Reverend Barber's talk on dominion, because he really lays it out clearly that dominion was misinterpreted by a lot of religious people. and it's not having, you know, superiority to everything. It's living with everything. It's being respectful of everything. And that includes our brothers and sisters, our neighbors, but also our wild brothers and sisters. And it is a bit of a challenge to explain this to some people, again, no matter what their religious background might be, because people just automatically go into this defense mechanism about, well, what about my rights? Why aren't my rights honored and respected? And I'm getting to the point in my process of understanding the rights of nature where I'm just getting really tired of the human-centric perspective on everything. It doesn't always have to be about humans. Let's consider our brothers and sisters who we're living with. And I realize that might sound a little kooky to people, but honestly, it's a really great way to live. And I feel as though I've been given this gift of recognizing that I always refer to them as mine. They're not mine, but I guess my family of trees, my family of birds, my family of lavender, everything living, everything around here, even the rocks, everything around here is part of this beautiful ecosystem and part of this area where I live, where I see myself as this caretaker. I'm not a quote unquote property owner. I am a caretaker here. I am the caregiver. This is a space for all of us to live together communally, instead of me being the person who, you know, chops down everything and destroys everything and then recreates whatever I think works best for me. It's, you know, let's plant whatever wants to grow here, and native plants and what I can grow for the birds and the bees and everybody else. It's not just for me. It's an interesting perspective, and I love that it's built a lot on indigenous histories and indigenous culture.
Yeah, you've used the term in referring to rights of nature a couple of times, kooky, and that's fair enough. I know that when I was first exposed to the idea, which hasn't been all that long ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the first time I heard it, I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You know, a river is going to sue. But as I've dug into it and taken a closer look at it, and also that's been a big step forward for me in understanding the concept is that as human beings, the evolution of rights, I'm sure every time rights were expanded, somebody, maybe most somebody's thought that that was a kooky idea. I mean, it's not that long ago that the only person in a society that had any rights at all was the monarch, the king, the queen. And we've slowly expanded that to, okay, well, propertied white males have rights. And we've expanded that into people, regardless of skin color or gender, having rights and so on. So it does seem like there's been a progression of expanding the idea of rights. And part of what I think I see in all of this is it's not only a philosophical idea, it's just like the world would be so much a better place if these various things in our environment had had the ability, the standing to go into court and say, hey, wait a minute, my rights are being abused here. Does that all make sense to you?
Yeah. And that would be ideal. And I'm just shocked because in the US, our environmental laws were basically created to protect corporations, not the environment. So when I listen to the lawyers talking about how we can get rights for the southern residents or anything, any rights for any of nature's inhabitants, it just boggles my mind and frustrates me to no end to think that, you know, these people are bending over backwards to find somewhere in the law where nature would have standing, and it's a struggle. I don't understand how we just went, you know, again to Mars. We're looking at other planets while we're destroying the one that we have instead of living with her and protecting and doing everything we can to keep her safe.
So are there jurisdictions, states or whatever, where rights of nature have gotten established and there's been some court cases or other kinds of tests of the concept?
Yeah, we've had some successes in the U.S. I don't have the list and I haven't memorized them all. But I know that, you know, in Toledo, Ohio, they were trying to get rights for Lake Erie and everything was really moving along well. And the politicians basically put the kibosh on everything and went so far as to say, yeah, nature has no standing and you can't bring any suits or of any kind in support of nature. So that was interesting. But Ecuador has had rights of nature in their constitution for a while, for more than 10 years. New Zealand has, as you mentioned, rights for rivers. There's rights for mountains and various ecosystems. Santa Monica has some rights for cetaceans. But we have good news, though, that the Salish Sea was just given Hope standing. She is now protected. Actually, she's put under Mission Blue has a Hope Project where they designate a sea as Hope Project. And so now the Salish Sea is now somewhat, she's considered a Hope Project.
Well, wow, that seems like a breakthrough. And I almost feel like we're getting a little real-time update on what's going on in that field. And once again, I'm going to put links in the show notes, and I would like to have a link to that too so people can learn more about it. You'd mentioned Reverend Barber talking about Dominion a little earlier. I'll have a link in there for that too. So we are getting close to the end of our time here, Chris, which I've enjoyed very much. So any other topics that you think would be good to put out within the framework of what we've been talking about?
No, I think this has been great. I misstated that. It's a Hope Spot. I think I kept calling it a Hope Project, a Hope Spot. So, and that's designated basically for areas that need support and that have endangered species. So that's a really great first step. But it doesn't give, again, when we talk about rights of nature, we talk about Endangered Species Act and others, and everyone's like, well, you have that. So why do the southern residents need to have rights of nature as well? It's because the Endangered Species Act can come and go depending on the administration, as we've seen. And so Yeah, it's interesting, and I hope that people would get involved, and I apologize. I don't do it justice nearly as well as the lawyers, but I am not a lawyer.
Yeah, well, that may be a blessing, but anyway. Yeah, we love our lawyers. We can't live without them, so no harm intended. Well, Chris, thanks so much for being with us, and I will encourage folks to check out the show notes after the fact, and let's continue to pay attention to our own emotional needs and our awareness about the environment and dig into this notion of rights of nature, which is really intriguing. And I think it really is it is an important answer to the devastation that we're really visiting on the environment we live in. And Chris, I think you made such an important point too earlier on. You said something like, well, the earth doesn't need us. We need the earth. And that is so true. I get this notion that some people think, well, we take care of nature because we want to be nice guys or something like that. It's not the way it works. This is our home. And if we don't take care of it, we're not going to have a home.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So thanks, Chris, and good luck, and have a great day.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So there you go. So great talking to Chris as we explore how we live life, deal with hardships, disappointment, and so on. And in particular, what we're talking about today, watching what's going on with the climate, with our environment, the political partisanship, the worries, the anxieties. How do we observe all of that, realize the reality of it, and still be able to enjoy our lives? I sure as heck don't want to spend my time here gloomy and not enjoying my life. And at the same time, I do want to be part of the solution. I think one of the major things that Chris pointed to in dealing with those mental health issues is having a community, a place to be, to talk to friends and explore and share what's going on in our lives. And I'd like to think that Climate Talk right here is a part of that kind of community. So it certainly is for me, and I'm grateful for this as a resource for myself. We're going to have bountiful show notes from today's conversation. You can find those at ccltacoma.org. The CCL stands for Citizens Climate Lobby. I am an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a good outfit. Check it out. You might find some value there. You can send me an email too at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. I'd love to hear from you, especially if you have some ideas about future shows or if I've said something that you think is just wrong and you want to straighten me out. So once again, here I am reminding you, as always, live like the mountain is out. Take care. Thank you.